It's Monday, everyone, and this is the takeaway for June 17th. Prosecutors in Michigan have dropped charges against officials involved in the Flint water crisis, but the investigation isn't over yet.
It is just as delayed. There's no way to look at it, no matter how optimistic you are. However, sometimes you have to be delayed to get things done right.
We'll hear from a lifelong Flint resident on whether the government can rebuild trust going forward. Also on the show, workers in the video game industry have had enough of unfair labor practices and now are attempting to unionize.
You're told in the gaming industry, you're lucky to be here. This is people's dream job. So if you don't like it, you can leave.
And it's been 4 years since the shooting at the historically Black Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston, South Carolina. We'll speak with two of the state's politicians about the legacy of the tragedy. Let's start in Flint, Michigan. This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega.
We would be taking a shower, and if you happen to have a cut or a scrape, your shower would just burn. It would burn like you were sticking your hand in acid.
Okay, well, now you got to start flushing your water for 25 minutes before you use it for anything.
There is no trust when it comes to our state government.
When it's a man-made disaster, specifically one led by elected officials, then there's a whole nother level of psychological trauma because these are people who you have put your trust in.
The state nurse told me, oh, I understand your son has lead poisoning, but it's not as bad as it could be. He's just gonna lose a few IQ points. No, that's my child. How would you feel if someone told you that about your child? How is that fair to him?
For the residents of Flint, Michigan, the fight for clean water has been a years-long nightmare. And last week, the possibility that government officials will ultimately be held accountable was temporarily put on hold. On Thursday, state prosecutors in Michigan announced that they were dropping all 8 pending criminal cases against officials involved in the Flint water crisis. The crisis goes back nearly 5 years, when a change in the city's water source led to dangerously high levels of lead in the blood of some Flint residents, including children. Scientists have also found evidence that the city's water system was to blame for a Legionnaires' disease outbreak in 2014 and 2015 that killed 12 people. In 2016, the Office of Michigan Attorney General Bill Schuette started an investigation looking into the Flint water crisis. And that investigation has cost taxpayers tens of millions of dollars. But this year, a new attorney general, Dana Nessel, took office and appointed 2 new prosecutors to oversee the Flint investigation. The decision to drop the remaining charges was made public in a statement from the prosecutors, which said that in the previous investigation, quote, all available evidence was not pursued. In other words, this isn't over yet. Chia Morgan is with me to talk about all this. She's a social worker and community activist and a lifelong Flint resident. And Steve Carmody is with us. He's a reporter with Michigan Radio based in Flint. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Hello, Tanzina.
Thanks for having us.
So Chia, let's start with you. We're talking a lot about Flint and water, but you live in Flint. What's the water like today?
There's been progress, you know, since the initial onset of the crisis, but we're still in recovery. So, you know, it's just a long process and it's hit or miss because some days your water may come back one way, some days your water may come back with another testing level, you know, so it's still frustrating. That's probably the best way to describe it.
And Chia, when you heard the news that these charges were being dropped, at least for now, what was your reaction to that?
I was hoping that, you know, this is one of those instances where our trust won't be broken again. And I want to take the Solicitor General at face value and say, you know, they told us that they're dropping the charges so that they can introduce new evidence. So I'm actually hopeful, you know, the trust in state government is not that great, but I'm hoping with the new administration that that brings, you know, something new, a new level of trust.
Steve, this has been going on at least since 2014, the water crisis in Flint, that is. And we know that 15 state and local officials have been charged in the investigation under the former Attorney General, Bill Schuette. What was the status of those cases, and how does that relate to the charges that are dropped most recently?
Of the 15, 7 had cut plea deals with prosecutors. In exchange for cooperating with the investigation, they received little to no penalty. They pled no contest generally to misdemeanor charges. There were 8 former and current government officials who were still facing criminal charges, but when the Solicitor General dismissed the charges without prejudice, they now currently don't have any criminal charges against them, though those charges or other charges could be brought back up.
And Steve, can you remind me what the concerns were about the original investigation?
The concerns centered on, you know, was the team that was brought in from the outside by the Attorney General, Bill Schuette, had they adequately fully investigated all the possible avenues that they could have in, during their 3 years looking into this? The current Attorney General, Dana Nessel, when she was running last year, brought that up as a concern that she had before she won the election. And once she put new people in charge, they started raising even more questions about what evidence had not been investigated. And that was something that has been a drumbeat that has been building for the last several months. So while the announcement that they were dismissing the charges did catch us a little bit by surprise, it wasn't completely unexpected because of all the concerns they had been raising for the last several months about the quality of the investigation and about the evidence that had not been looked into.
Tia, do you feel that, I mean, how do you feel about the fact that these charges might end up being refiled or potentially having more evidence the second time around? Do you feel like this is justice delayed?
I mean, it is justice delayed. There's no way to look at it, no matter how optimistic you are. However, sometimes you have to be delayed to get things done right. You know, my parents always raised me that haste makes waste. So had this new team come in and tried to build a case off of what they didn't feel in their heart would have been, you know, a win, then it's likely that all charges would have been dropped and it wouldn't have been without prejudice. So I think that, you know, money has been wasted. There is a delay, but we can't put that on this current administration. And so that's why I'm not as upset, because there is an opportunity that some of these people who are still working in state government will actually face the judgment that they really deserve.
And Chia, are there other officials that people on the ground who were in Flint would like to see charged that had not been charged in the initial round?
Absolutely. There's no way that, you know, these charges should have been brought without our former governor, Rick Snyder, being in jail. So we are super optimistic that there is something to implicate him and that charges will be filed. And I will say, you know, this team, they've been searching cell phone records and they've been doing all of that. So they are doing their due diligence to show us, you know, that they are working on this. And to echo what Steve said, we knew that this was possibly coming because Dana Nessel hit the ground saying that she was going to do everything she could to make sure that justice was served. And I also echo his sentiments that we were a little caught off guard on Friday that, hey, this is happening now, but we weren't blindsided.
Steve, what happens now? I mean, where do the prosecutors go?
Well, at this point, they have to plow through a lot more potential evidence than what the previous team had been working on. And they're under something of a growing time constraint. There is a statute of limitations for them to file on certain charges. And with the switch in the city's water system occurring in April of 2014, it really, in many cases, will give them only until the spring of next year to file new charges. So I would expect that we'll get through the summer and then maybe in the fall we'll start seeing criminal charges being filed once again. Now, who exactly will be charged and what they'll be charged with will depend on the evidence that they have available to them and what they can think they can make stick. And we may see new players being charged. We may see some of the people who had been charged not charged again. And so the severity of some of the charges, for example, the state's former state health department director had been facing involuntary manslaughter charges. We'll see if the new team will move forward with those charges again, or if they'll go after him on lesser penalties.
And Steve, Chia gave us an update on the water situation in Flint. Do you have any additional details on what's happening, whether or not people are still using bottled water, maybe what the percentages are as far as folks who have clean water, if I can even say that?
The latest testing shows that the 90th percentile, the most at-risk homes being tested, their lead quality was about 4 parts per billion, which is well within federal and state standards for lead exposure. Now, ideally, zero lead is what you want in your water, and that's what the majority of homes that are tested are coming back as. That's, you know, the information we've received from the state. There are many people who in Flint will never trust what they hear from the government again about the quality of their drinking water. They were lied to repeatedly for a very long time, and they will never trust, you know, whatever numbers come out about the quality of the drinking water in Flint. That's why when different churches and civic groups have water giveaways, there are always very long lines of people getting in line to get bottled water because, again, they do not trust and will never trust the water coming out of their tap.
Chia, we know that 2020 is a huge election coming up for this country. Presidential candidates are, some of them at least, are talking about the Flint water crisis. And you recently spoke to Julian Castro, who's the former HUD secretary, who was in Flint to talk about this. What did you say to him?
I asked him not to make us a campaign stop or a campaign talking point. I asked him to definitely promise us that win, lose, or draw in 2020, that he would stick with us, help us, you know, fight even on the campaign trail when you're going to these different cities. Give these cities an update on what you found out in Flint here. Ask them to send 10 cases. Ask them to send 20 cases because he's essentially going to touch all 50 states. So those cases add up because, as Steve stated, when we have these water drives, the lines are wrapped around buildings. They're wrapped around streets and corners. So we're still in need of water.
So, Chia, when you see people, particularly on social media, who say, you know, celebrities even, who say Flint still doesn't have clean water, or politicians who use that as a talking point, how do you feel?
You know, there are some celebrities, and I have seen them, I have, you know, witnessed it. They're not just using that as a way to get 1.2 million likes. They're genuinely saying Flint doesn't have clean water. You know, they've been phenomenal. But for too many people, it's just a cool post to make. And for too many candidates, it is just something, you know, oh, we're going to pull at the heartstrings because everyone in the nation felt for Flint. And it is more than disheartening. It just angers you so much that people are just so callous, you know, that they just use you for their own benefit. We're tired of that.
Steve, we are hearing about similar water, tainted water in Newark, New Jersey, for example. And I'm wondering, when you look at this situation, what does it tell you about how difficult it is to essentially hold officials accountable in these types of environmental disasters?
It is difficult to do that, often because the decisions that they make, even if they're making incorrect decisions, they're not necessarily breaking the law with the decisions that they make. For example, the former State Health Department Director, Nick Lyon, who was facing involuntary manslaughter charges because of decisions he made related to a Legionnaire's disease outbreak that occurred at the same time as the Flint water crisis. The question is, did he actually break the law in the decisions that he made? The crux of the charges against him was he didn't notify the public that there was a Legionnaire's disease outbreak, and some people thought that he should have. Well, the department did notify hospitals, did notify doctors to be on the lookout for Legionnaires in Genesee County. They took the steps that they were required to by law and expected to by law. But, you know, did he actually break the law, and were his decisions actually illegal? You know, that's a difficult decision to make. When you're dealing with someone who is, you know, a politician, an elected official, a government official, someone who is making their decisions and they are acting within the law, the way the laws are written, it's difficult then to prosecute them.
Steve Carmody is a reporter with Michigan Radio based in Flint, and Chia Morgan is a Flint resident and activist. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is The Takeaway with Tanzina Vega from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with WGBH Radio in Boston.
An estimated 67% of Americans play video games on at least one type of device. And last week, game studios rolled out their slate of upcoming games and consoles at E3, one of the largest annual games conferences, which helps set the pace for the nearly $138 billion a year industry. While the newest Halo and Zelda games get all the attention, it's easy to lose sight of the developers who spend thousands of hours actually making these games. For years now, exploitative labor practices at game studios have forced developers to work 100-hour weeks without overtime pay, creating a disgruntled industry that burns out their employees early in their careers. And now these practices have finally led workers in the gaming industry to try to unionize. Alana Samuels is senior economics correspondent at Time Magazine, and she says the most common complaint from developers is about the grueling hours they work during a time they call crunch.
So crunch is something that's very common in the gaming industry. You see it in tech, too. But it's basically the period before a game is released where people are working around the clock to get things finished, to make sure everything's perfect. And unless they're contractors, they don't get paid extra for that time. So it's usually 90 to 100 hour weeks for a lot of weeks in a row where you're just working around the clock. Some people sleep there on the floor on cots, and then you get up and do it again.
Now, what's interesting is that you said this is without pay. Are there other issues that developers are concerned about in addition to this crunch issue?
Well, I think crunch is the big one just because it's becoming so much more common as games have updates and new releases more frequently. But gamers also talk about the number of contractors, so that's people who aren't employees, who just have really unstable lifestyles because they don't know when they're going to get a job, they don't have benefits, and they don't have any, you know, surety that their jobs are going to continue. Gamers also talk about sexism. I think the game industry is about 70% male, so women often feel like they don't have a voice and that they're passed over for promotions. So those are some of the big issues that people are talking about.
Now, it's not like people aren't paying for games, right? Whether they're on their apps or whether they're buying games for their PlayStation or what have you. So why is it that these folks are going without pay or expected to go without pay?
Well, I think it's just been something that's been going on in the game industry for so long that it's really hard to change. And I heard from a lot of people that you're told in the gaming industry, you're lucky to be here. This is people's dream job. So if you don't like it, you can leave. And these companies are, you know, they don't have to pay workers more because people have put up with it so long. Why would they offer to pay for 90-hour weeks when they're currently paying for 40-hour weeks? And a lot of people who work in the industry are pretty young. They're just getting their start, and they don't really want to say, hey, this isn't right. You know, I can't live like this for much longer.
And why is there so much pressure to get games out at a certain date?
Well, so it used to be the date. Now it's more just that there are all these updates. So game companies really want players to fall in love with a game and just spend all their time on one game, spend a lot of money on that game, buying, you know, grenades and extra special packs. And so rather than just releasing one game a year, they're releasing updates all the time. And a lot of these companies are talking about cloud gaming. And that's kind of, imagine a game being streaming, so available like a Netflix show instead of having to download it, which means it can be updated constantly, which some analysts say is going to actually create more crunch because companies just want players to really keep coming back to the game, saying, oh, look at this new feature, spending money on it. And that's where they're hoping to make a lot of their money.
So looks like what you're reporting on is that a lot of these folks have had enough and want to form a union. Where does that stand?
Well, so it's interesting because the union is very separated. There are all these different branches across the country, and they kind of work together on social media, but they're all organizing separately. So in the Bay Area, there are a couple of mid-sized studios where about 10 to 20% of the employees are actually on the bargaining committee trying to get other people to sign up. But, you know, the Game Workers Unite union kind of founders told me they've just kind of given up on the big companies. They really don't think it's going to happen for the big companies. So they're going for the middle companies. So it's really depends on the city and the state across the country. There's definitely a lot of talk about it on social media, and a lot of people are interested. Whether that will go to a union vote or not, that's a little unclear right now.
And have the major studios responded to any of the complaints? Have they offered I would imagine they're not in favor of unionization, so have they offered any olive branches to entice workers not to try to unionize?
No, they haven't really spoken of it directly. You know, it's this whole unionization thing started or really gained traction last year during this industry conference where there was this panel where the industry was basically saying, here's why you shouldn't unionize. And it was all these panelists saying why unions would be bad. And that got people really mad, kind of poked the hornet's nest. And that got people really interested in the union. So I think they've perhaps learned their lesson that not saying anything about this is probably their best way to go.
And what happens if the unions are not able to move forward and these labor practices aren't going checked? I mean, what happens to the industry? Does it just continue to burn people out like this?
Yeah, what you have is people who aren't going to stay for very long. And so you lose a lot of expertise in the industry. And that's hard for companies. You know, recruiting talent, especially right now when the economy is pretty strong, the unemployment rate is low, recruiting talent is really hard. And so if you're driving people out with bad working conditions, it's expensive to recruit new people. You know, on the other hand, the International Game Developers Association had a report in 2004. It said, many developers are fed up with the crunch cycle and they're going to leave the industry. We can ill afford to lose them. They said the exact same thing in 2017. So, you know, the industry is saying it's worried about people losing interest or kind of getting fed up. But so far, it really hasn't done anything to change working conditions. And I think that's why workers are really starting to get organized now.
Alana Samuels is senior economics correspondent at Time Magazine. Alana, thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
We have 9 victims in this heinous crime that has been committed.
Pray for the family, Papa. They got a long road ahead.
He's a white male. He's a younger white male.
I'm scared to talk about the real issue, which is rape.
I do believe this was a hate crime.
Yeah. That's what we duck around from. We don't want to talk about these issues. They're here. They're in our community.
Heartbreaking scene I have never witnessed in my life.
We want the entire community to pray for safety for our people, and that we would hope that this person who has committed this heinous crime, which is a hate crime, be brought to justice.
They say this person is extremely dangerous.
We need every tip we can get.
What we need now is to get the assistance of the community.
We are communities trying to live and survive. Why do we have to live like this?
4 years ago today, horror unfolded in Charleston, South Carolina. As people gathered for prayer at the Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church, a white supremacist gunman shot and killed 9 black parishioners. One of the victims of the shooting was Clementa Pinckney, a South Carolina state senator and a senior pastor at the church. Marlon E. Kimpson, a Democratic state senator in South Carolina, was close to Senator Pinckney, and he joins me now. Senator Kimpson, thanks for being with us.
Good to be with you.
Senator, you knew Senator Pinckney well. Tell us who he was as a person.
Well, I'd like to say that Clementa was, in my view, the moral conscience of the South Carolina General Assembly. He was a very humble but yet impactful representative of his district, pastor of Mother Emmanuel. And he had a number of causes which we have certainly tried to continue, not to his level, but certainly tried to carry the baton in what he believed that we should be doing as an elected official and in the General Assembly. He was a father to 2 beautiful little girls, a husband to a beautiful wife who is carrying on his legacy through many different nonprofit organizations. And so we dearly miss him in our county. We dearly miss him in our state. And his church congregation dearly misses him in his sanctuary.
Senator, what has changed politically in South Carolina in these 4 years since this horrific shooting?
Well, in the aftermath of the shooting, as you know, we were able to rid our state house in front of the state house of the Confederate battle flag. But the way that it was put there, it was protected by something called the Heritage Act, which protected Confederate memorials all across the state, including the state house. So in order to do that, we had to have 2/3 majority in both the House and Senate. Some have opined that that kind of legislation is unconstitutional. It ought to just take a simple majority. But nevertheless, because the racist who murdered the 9 in the attempted murder of the survivors coveted this racist symbol, we thought it'd be appropriate to send a message to the rest of the world that we need to put divisive symbols like the Confederate flag and other memorabilia behind us. And we acted as swiftly as we could, given our rules, and we did that. Now, there's a lot of substantive work to be done in South Carolina with respect to race relations. I spoke last night to the Charleston Forum, and I echoed the theme of economics, something that I have argued forcefully for on the General Assembly floor. We got to have some money in the communities that matter. We got to close the income gap. There's really not much wealth in the African-American community in the state of South Carolina, and so we got to look at that, and I was pleased to be a part of the Black Economic Alliance Presidential Forum, where economics was the key, and so and widely discussed by several of the presidential candidates this weekend. And so that is our focus now, after ridding ourselves of a symbolic symbol. We got to move on the substance of policy, and in my view, we should have a focus on economics. And Clem and the nine would were all very involved people in the issues surrounding housing and health care and closing the living wage gap that exists in Charleston County in the state of South Carolina.
Senator, you've also supported closing a loophole that helped the Charleston shooter purchase his guns. Can you tell us what the status of that legislation is today?
Unfortunately, I'm not pleased to tell you we hadn't had much traction. There is not a merit-based argument in our state and, quite frankly, around the country. We have gun mania that controls many of the state legislators. They can pay people, lobbyists, the NRA and other groups, to be there all day and report names back to the headquarters and direct funding to those conservative members, specifically Republicans, who work with Democrats to bring common-sense gun solutions. When you poll the people in the state and, quite frankly, the nation, people understand that if you can have a background check completed when you're buying a house or a credit card, they certainly see the need to have a background check completed when you buy military artillery. And so, unfortunately, we have a lot of spineless members of the conservative parties who are mere order takers, come to Columbia every day on bended knee, carrying out the orders of the NRA to not only block gun reform, but also expand gun expansion bills such as open carry and the like.
Senator Marlon E. Kimson is a Democratic state senator in South Carolina. Senator, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
House Representative James E. Clyburn is a Democrat representing South Carolina's 6th District, and he's also the House Majority Whip. Congressman Clyburn, thank you for joining us on The Takeaway.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Congressman, we are marking 4 years since the Mother Emanuel Church shooting today. What are your thoughts today?
Well, I'm very hopeful that the Senate, Mr. McConnell, will see they were clear to approve the legislation we've sent them. We've taken two steps in the House of Representatives to address gun laws. We have passed what we call H.R. 6, which is broaden the background checks so that we close the loophole that applied to gun shows. And we have passed H.R. 1112, which we put forth just after the Emanuel shooting to close what has become known as the Charleston loophole. Now, that bill simply says that under current law, you've got 3 days to carry out a background check. And if the background check is not completed within 3 days, then you can just get the gun. What we're saying with this legislation is the fact that if for some reason the background check has not been completed in the 3-day period, time ought to be given as to determine why. and not allow the gun purchase to go forward, because it could be some mistaken entry into the record. It could be somebody misrepresenting their own background, their own name, their own address, which is what happened with Dylan Roof. He got that gun and was not supposed to be able to get a gun because at the end of the three-day period, something had gone wrong in the information. They found it 5 days later. But when they found it, it was too late. He had the gun. And all you can do at that point is, please bring us the gun back, which has happened, I believe, in, I don't want to call the state, because another case, this happened earlier when they said, please bring us the gun back. Well, he did not bring the gun back and killed a lot of people subsequently. So here we are saying we don't want to inconvenience 4% of gun purchases. Only 4% of gun purchases would be subjected to this law. But that's about the percentage of people who you expect to do ill will once they get a gun. And so I would hope that the Senate will bring these bills to the floor and let's vote on them. I think they'll pass if Mitch McConnell will put them on the floor.
Congressman, you mentioned the name of the shooter, who was also an avowed white supremacist. We have seen additional and other incidents of white supremacist violence targeting people of color, particularly Black Americans in this country. And yet we seem to not, at the federal level at least, be able to call enough attention to the issue of white nationalism. What are your thoughts on that? Where do you think Congress should head with that?
Well, I think that one of the things, though I understand it, when we don't call the names of these people, but I call the name because I want people listening to this show to put the name in and to find out who I'm talking about and to really join in this effort to see exactly what this young man did and why he did it. He did not cloak in any way what his intentions were. He was online posting stuff. White supremacy reigned supreme in his thought process. He celebrated the Confederate battle flag, which was never the Confederate flag. I'm just amazed at how people just latch on to these misrepresentations, these untruths, and put them out there. We see that going on with this president. Just put something out there. You know it's not true, and you celebrate it. That battle flag that this young man celebrated was never the Confederate flag.
Congressman, I'm asking whether or not the federal government is doing enough to address the specific incidents of white supremacist and white nationalist violence in the United States.
No, it's not. And I think that one of my faults is I like to get the background and stuff, because why we aren't doing enough is because we continue to buy into these misrepresentations. You see the president getting up saying this is about destroying those monuments, the great Robert E. Lee. Nothing was great about Robert E. Lee. The man was a traitor. The man was an inhuman slave owner. And here we are celebrating it. That's why we aren't doing enough, because we aren't accepting the truth as it is. If we were to accept the truth about Robert E. Lee, you would not have the president misrepresented why we had that problem there in Charlottesville, Virginia. We all who know the history know why they were marching, and we know why they had the countermarches out there, because they're trying to protect something which is just not true.
Congressman, what should be done in this country, from your view, to address this issue of white supremacist violence?
The first thing we should do is give as much credence to the Second Amendment as we give to the First Amendment. We're always talking about the First Amendment, freedom of speech, but as the courts have said time and time again, that freedom does not give you the right to yell fire in a crowded theater. Yes, you have Second Amendment rights, but there are constraints. There should be constraints on Second Amendment rights, just like there are constraints on First Amendment rights. You don't have unfettered right to do anything in this country. We regulate people's activities because everybody will not be in this for the right purposes. So the first thing we need to recognize is that the Second Amendment, and what is so strange about this, the late Justice Scalia even expressed constraints on Second Amendments. But the legislature, the Congress, the United States Senate, seem to take the notion that there should not be any constraints on gun ownership, and that is absolutely ludicrous.
Congressman, just pivoting for a minute here, you knew some of the victims of the Mother Emanuel Church shooting. Have you been able to speak to any of their family members this week?
This week, no. I was in Charleston a couple of days ago. I speak with them all the time. I've had them up to Washington. My church is in Charleston, Morris Brown AME Church, around the corner from Emanuel. And I was at Emanuel 2 days ago. So I talk to them all the time. I make no attempt to do anything on a special occasion. In fact, I spoke at Mrs. Hurd's service. I know the family and all of those families very, very well.
Are you optimistic that South Carolina will be able to move forward from this?
No, I'm not. You had Marlon Kempson on earlier, Senator Kempson. I'm not optimistic at all. But I'm never going to give up. I'm always hopeful that the next day just may be the day.
House Representative James Clyburn is a Democrat representing South Carolina's 6th District. Congressman Clyburn, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And that's our show for today. You can always weigh in on anything you hear on The Takeaway, write to us on our Facebook page, or send us a message on Twitter. Thanks for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.